No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So feel free to call in at 888-627-6008 and become part of the discussion. Or you can Skype your questions to BBSRADIOPR. Good evening, everybody, and welcome. Maria, welcome.
Welcome. Hi. Good afternoon. Good evening.
Yeah, and we've got a very special guest tonight, an old friend of mine, Adam Eidegger. Adam is one of D.C.'s premier political activists, having been involved locally and nationally in a wide range of social justice issues. His causes include anti-war, cannabis and hemp politics, GMO labeling, and D.C. statehood. And beyond that, Adam and I have been arrested together outside the United States Senate, standing up for the rights of D.C. citizens to fund health care for poor women. And we're also tossed out of a Senate office together, where Adam showed great courage in demanding a meeting, which he actually got. I was amazed at how strong he was and how committed he is. And he's an inspiration to all of us that are in the movement to get equal rights for the people of the District of Columbia. Adam, welcome. Thanks for being on the show.
Wow, that's quite the introduction. Thank you. you know, I was just thinking, if we're going to talk about multiple issues tonight, I'd like to start off with statehood, because I know that's your wheelhouse. And I was speaking with Natalie White, the ERA activist, with this group called Equal Means Equal. And they've been spending a lot of time in Richmond and successfully got passage of the Equal Rights Amendment. This is the final state, 38th state, it's required to add it to the U.S. Constitution. However, they're suing currently in federal court, and having to sue because there was a seven-year maximum period that was given by Congress on the constitutional amendment. And, you know, back in the 80s, the time ran out on the ERA. And but recently, states have decided to pick up the mantle, and that restriction of just 7 years to pass the amendments, that was unconstitutional. And you might recall, there was at the same time as the ERA, there was also a D.C. statehood constitutional amendment effort that failed to receive enough states to ratify. Now, if this ERA group succeeds with their appeal, it will be added to the Constitution, because they are now at 38 states. Illinois and Nevada passed it in the last couple years as well, in addition now to Virginia, because they were three states short. If that happens, you know, I would think there's a compelling argument to then start campaigning to bring back the constitutional amendment, or at least pass it in more states for D.C. statehood. What do you think about that?
It's a great question. And by the way, I've got to tell you, since this passed in Virginia, my favorite comment from one of the people that wants to tie this up in court was that this would give women total control over their own bodies.
Imagine
how crazy, what a crazy idea that is. But I think that we have a problem there in that the court always seems to tell us that this is not a legal problem, but a political problem. And they have, you know, ever since every court case that I can remember, they've stepped back from for one reason or another, falling back on the district clause in the Constitution. So I don't know how viable that is. But, you know, my opinion, Adam, is that we should always be in court. We should always be out, you know, protesting. We should always be everywhere. So I certainly would run it up the flagpole if that happens. But I don't know.
It's ripe again if let's just say hypothetically the Democrats regain the Senate and maintain control of the House and the Democrats in the White House. At that point, there would be no excuse for the House and Senate to the Democrats would pass it. I mean, you're a Democrat. I think they would pass it. The statehood legislation that's, you know, created the Douglas Commonwealth. It does not get rid of the District of Columbia. You know, the District of Columbia will exist. And it's a really creative solution, and I think it can withstand constitutional scrutiny. But let's say it didn't, because, you know, Republicans are going to sue, and they're going to say, no. And they're going to go to a Trump judge and the Trump Supreme Court and, you know, and try to over. So you play that out, and, you know, maybe 3-4 years down the line from now, we'll be looking at potentially, if we don't succeed with this new current strategy, having to do a constitutional amendment as the only option. And it would be nice to not have to start from scratch, just go back to that amendment. So I'm actually watching this ERA case really closely because, you know, I think you gave me all this credit as being a great activist, but, you know, I'm a strategist. That's what I usually do. I'm looking ahead and, and I just look at looking ahead on the statehood fight. I mean, I really hope the current strategy succeeds. I know. I think, I mean, this is a strategy that Eleanor Holmes Norton has championed and all of us have dutifully come out and campaigned for the Douglas Commonwealth. But, you know, if it doesn't succeed in this next couple of years, which is going to be potentially the ideal timing, I'm going to lose faith in it. You know, I'm going to try. We need to try something else, like a constitutional amendment, a new one if we have to. You know, it's just it's getting kind of ridiculous that we have so many people in this town who have moved here from out of state where they're used to having basic voting rights. And they're just shocked still, you know. And I'm like, I was you 28 years ago, you know. When I moved here, I was shocked as well, like coming from Pennsylvania, just that people are giving up their rights to live in the capital city. I mean, it doesn't make any sense in the 21st century. And if there ever was like a case where people who didn't have telephone, who didn't have internet, shouldn't be writing the rules for people who do have telephone and internet today or TV or radio. I mean, the Founding Fathers imagined a world where the people in proximity did have a lot more influence, but I just don't think it's the case anymore. You can have just as much influence from California on your lawmakers, I believe.
What I found about the conversation about D.C. statehood is that there seems to be a fair amount of apathy that's going on. Because otherwise, we've talked with many, many guests who talked about back in the day, there would be weekly protests to keep it in people's faces and in their minds. And now Michael refers to when you have gatherings, you might get 200 or 300 people.
Yeah. Well, I'm not too concerned about the numbers of people turning out because we have the Congress on our side. We have a majority in the House now supporting the Douglas Commonwealth being created, and I think we're really close. I actually am impressed that the Democratic Party has finally put D.C. statehood into its DNA. I don't believe that was the case 30 years ago when Eleanor Holmes Norton was coming into office. It was a very different situation. I mean, they did have a vote, and it lost with the Democrats in control of the House. I think there's no question now that there would be an outright rebellion in the party by too many members. I think the party is becoming very progressive. We're about to see, I think, a progressive sweep in California that's going to inspire the rest of the country to get on the Bernie train. I am a Bernie Sanders supporter, and, you know, I'm not going to apologize for supporting him to, I actually think the moderates in the party, it's time for them to step aside. The moderates have been destroying the public policy positions of the party for three decades, and it's time to, we need a swing to the left, and it's going to be the way we course correct after this radical nationalist we have in the White House now, and his gang of enablers in the Senate. I think they're going to get tossed out, and they're really making a huge mistake. So I think that we're in a really great position. DC needs to remain scandal free, however. And maybe this can lead us to talking about Jack Evans, if you want to talk about that a little
bit. Well, you know what? That's the gorilla in the room, right? For those of listeners who may not know what Adam just referred to, we have a council member. In fact, he's the longest serving member of the DC council, and he just resigned. He just resigned in the face of great malfeasance, where he was about to be tossed out. And Adam led a recall effort in his ward, and Adam's effort resulted in almost 5,600 signatures of people that wanted him recalled. So that's my first question to you, Adam. You think that helped put pressure on him to resign, the recall thing?
I think it showed to the D.C. Council that there was real public support for him to be removed from office. This wasn't just a few commentators and a few journalists and a few insiders in the party, and a couple squeaky wheels in the neighborhood. This was proof that a large swath of the constituents agreed that at the very least we should have an election to decide if he can remain in office. And, let's just go back to February when this all started, for me at least. I mean, to give some credit, there were Jeffrey Anderson and the independent journalist DC Dig, and that's his his website, was really scraping away, digging up things, FOIAing the council, FOIAing Jack Evans, and they were the ones that he was the one that really broke the story that there was a lot, basically a pay-to-play culture, that you could hire Jack Evans as a consultant while he's a council member to do your bidding. And there were a lot of scandals that go back literally decades with all kinds of development in the city where Jack was involved basically doing the bidding of the developer and meanwhile was taking money from the developer through either a law firm job. I'm not sure if your listeners know this either, that D.C. council members who are paid $144,000 a year, plus a lot of perks, they can have outside employment, and this outside employment is the corrupting influence.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And so Jack, had been working at law firms, some very shady law firms, by the way, in D.C. for decades, and then only recently created his own consulting firm. And his consulting firm had no employees, and it was run out of his house, out of his bedroom, I guess you could say. And when it came time to seeking clients, this is the part that got me and my daughter really talking about what's a recall over a Sunday morning breakfast. It was reading in the paper, on the front page of the Post, that there had been FOIAs done, and that he had been shown to use his council staff to write letters. He sent letters from his council office, from his council email, to potential clients soliciting paid work. And it's like, wait, these people are paid for by the taxpayers. They are not your personal secretaries. They're not your personal, salespeople who are going to sell your law firm or sell your consulting firm or whatever he was offering. But when the letter, you read the letter that he was sent out, it was basically a pitch that, he's the chairman of the Metro Board. He is the one of only 13 lawmakers in D.C. He actually used that language, who writes all the laws. It was just so blatantly peddling his influence. Why would you hire this guy except for the reason that he is a council member? And I'm reading this, and I'm like, how is he still in office? How is the FBI not breaking down his door? I mean, this is why we have an FBI investigating politicians, because they shouldn't. They are in a great position of power. They're in a great position of public trust. As soon as they violate that public trust and try to, in order to enrich themselves, to become rich, we turn into Russia. We turn into a kleptocracy. You know.
Well, let me ask you something, Adam. Do you think that he shouldn't have resigned? Do you think that the council should have dumped him? That they shouldn't have given him, you know, allowed him to commit Harry Caray or whatever you want to call it, to step aside? Because they've never once gotten rid of anybody. And let's be honest, it's not just Jack. It's been Harry Thomas, Michael Brown, Kwame Brown, Jack, Vincent Orange, Jim Graham, Vincent Gray. I mean, there's a lot of corruption in D.C., right?
Should the voters get rid of corrupt politicians in this town? They don't last long. You know, Jim Graham was tossed out. Ruby May sold out the activists in her own community and aligned with Mayor Bowser on a bunch of issues, including the marijuana issue when it came to social use, which was a big issue for people living in public housing because they have nowhere to smoke marijuana. And we targeted her, and a whole bunch of people targeted her, and Trayvon White was elected instead. You know, I think that's politics. Sometimes it isn't just corruption. It's just betraying the people that you said you represented. So we have, you know, I think D.C. is very responsive and people don't stay in office very long. But Jack somehow stayed in office because he had done so many favors for so many people over the years that he really did have a loyal following. And I'll admit, up until 2019, I used Jack as a tool. You could go to Jack's office and you could get him to do things on cannabis very, very easily. He just didn't want to be on the wrong side of the issue. We did photo ops with him, handing him a joint in his council office, because it's actually legal to do that, to give a congressman, or council member, I should say. Actually, it would be legal to give a congressman, too, or a senator, a joint in D.C., because we allow the sharing of cannabis in limited quantities, and we were just demonstrating that it was a harmless act. But, you know, Jack Evans posed with us. I mean, he was not shy around drug policy reform. He's not shy around LGBTQ issues. He was extremely responsive to people in Georgetown. If you had a lot of money, he was responsive to you. Right. I don't feel he was responsive to low-income people in the ward. I feel like he was tone-deaf to those that were suffering gentrification of their community, particularly in the Shaw neighborhood. I think he supported the actual gerrymandering of the ward, so a large section of black voters were cut out 10 years ago. I really got to know Ward 2 on this. You know, I want to point out that Jack played pretty dirty over the years. Anyone who tried to run, he would like hire a private investigator and try to dig up dirt on them. And, you know, he made entering politics a really dirty thing. Like you scary, you know. And, you know, I'm just not scared of people. Like, I'm not afraid to be hated. The Washington Post did a magazine cover, Washington Post magazine did a cover story about me, and that there's a picture of me, and the headline was "Willing to be hated." And it's like, it's true. Like, I don't care. I don't want to be in bed with a corrupt politician, even if he's good on my issue. You know, like, I can't turn a blind eye to the fact that he's just so corrupt, you know?
Was he charged with anything? I mean, Michael, you mentioned malfeasance, and Adam, you mentioned corruption, but everything that I've read doesn't say that
never
he suffered any... Right. So like how is that possible?
Well, this isn't over, right? Adam, he can still
I agree.
Charged.
I don't think it's over yet, and I think there may be a wider case against him and other council members. But here's the deal. He was selling access to his office. He was peddling it, and he had been hired repeatedly. I mean, the East Bank deal is really sketchy, to say the least. East Bank got $20 million from the Metro's reserve fund. Now, East Bank's a local bank, and I get it. They want the money. But this money is just sitting there. It's Metro's emergency reserve fund. It just sits in a bank. Well, you know, I can't help but think that maybe he steered that money into East Bank. You know, there's not a lot of evidence there, but that's something that people are looking into. There definitely are cases with the DigiSign Media where he was issued 200,000 shares of stock, and while he was consulting them, and then got legislation introduced in the council while he's a council member. So he's like helping this company that doesn't even exist yet. He's going to own the company, and they're going to put obnoxious, glaring, hurt your eye, glowing signs all over town in our nation's capital. We're going to look like Manhattan now. And yes. I mean, this is, he was willing to sell out the beauty of Washington, D.C. to a cheap kind of, you know, digital sign advertising you every moment you walk down the street. You're walking your dog and you're going to be advertised at. You know, like, we don't want that here in our community. And there's a reason why the community doesn't look like that now, is because the community has stood up to it. But he was ready to sell out on that. Now, he got caught. He had to return the stock, which he did. He had to return the money he got. He did. He had many clients that he did not reveal in the end. But in the end, there was a report made by the D.C. Council. Let's just rewind. After the scandal broke in February that he was using his council staff to, like, enrich himself, then the Metro started to look into him, and the Metro board realized that he had a conflict of interest there because he was receiving money from multiple parking companies that had business with, like, Colonial Parking, and they had business with Metro. And so, you know, here's a guy who's getting money from a parking company, then he's setting policy for the Metro, which deals with parking and transportation issues. I mean, it's just he's getting paid off. He's getting paid for influence. It's really obvious. And, you know, so these investigations start to occur, and then they realize there really was influence peddling, that he was selling his influence on as chairman of the Metro board, and it's in writing, like his own letters prove it. So he was forced off as chairman of the Metro, and that was, like, you know, supposed to appease people. But then later, the council, he was stripped of his committee chairmanship of the D.C. Finance Committee. He basically set the tax rates in the city, and then he's taking all this money from business interests. You know, it's just so bad. You know, we need people that have no connection to these business interests deciding what the tax rates are, not someone who can say, you know, we're going to tax this less and that more because you gave me money.
First of all, I got to tell you, I agree with you that Jack – you know, Jack did things for our delegation too, and we had a good relationship with Jack. But there's got to be a bottom line, right? You can't do the kind of things that he's been accused of in government, because you're right about everything you're saying. This is the problem with corruption in government, is that you can do things like this. But I think, you know, I think there's a culture in the District of Columbia. I got to tell you, in the government, I think that it's fast and loose, and that who knows where the Jack Evans investigation will ultimately lead. But the
trail that he's left behind, just based on what you and Adam have been sharing, is ridiculous, including his legacy of 30 years. I mean, I'm shocked because, like you said, Adam, when you're on the Metro board and then you're getting payments for parking, like, isn't that a conflict of interest, do you think?
Yeah, and there were at least a dozen crimes that were outlined in the council's investigation. So, the D.C. Council did form an ad hoc committee. It was chaired by Mary Che, who is a law professor at George Washington University and Ward 3 councilwoman. She, I have to say, is a really honest broker, you know, someone who looks at facts and substance. And that ad hoc committee gave Jack Evans a chance to come in and defend himself, and he didn't show up. And it was really offensive, you know. Like, if you think you deserve to stay on the council, you can at least come and answer these questions. And I kind of remember, you know, Trayon White from Ward 8, the council member there, he was in trouble with the Jewish community for comments he made and for, you know, that were considered insensitive at the very least. And there had to be, you know, a lot of meetings and outreach to the Jewish community by him to get back into understanding. It was really a teaching moment for everybody. in the city as to, you know, anti-Semitic tropes. And he really turned it around by engaging, by, you know, and so if Jack Evans was like, oh, I didn't realize I was breaking the rules, so that's basically his defense, in the media at least. He never really presented a formal defense to the council. He just sort of blew them off. And I think he set himself up to be expelled, you know, and so let's just look at this. So they made this report with a third party. It was a law firm, and a law firm not known to be, you know, a bunch of lefty progressives. It was a very moderate law firm that the council, I think, spent $120,000 on this report. It was a formal investigation, and when they presented the report, they said there was at least a dozen crimes here. You know, even though he hasn't been charged by the U.S. attorney yet, there was an FBI raid of his house that happened in the summertime back on June 21st, I believe. And that was in the news. It was kind of a big deal. We were collecting signatures for the recall at the time. And I remember our signature collection really spiked around that time because people started to realize that this guy's still in office. He's still collecting a check and still voting on legislation. And he, you know, he's very close to being indicted. There is a grand jury. But nobody's heard anything what the outcome is. And it's probably because there just isn't enough evidence, or maybe they decide it's not a high priority. I don't know. But the council did get this report, and then at the following hearing in December for the ad hoc committee, you know, Mary Che had been telling people to have, you know, we're probably going to censure him, and she actually told me this the night before the vote. I gave her a call, and we had never spoke this whole time as the recall was going on, and I said, you know, I'm the proposer of the recall, and she knew who I was, and I explained that while the signatures we turned in were more than the required number and the raw number, when they're validated, I'm pretty confident we're going to be short by a few hundred. It's really sad. You know, we have like 9.5%. You need 10% of the registered voters to sign. I said, but that's just a fact of life. You know, I never thought we'd get this many, but we really came close. So if you don't remove him, if you don't vote to expel him, he's going to keep his job. I just want to make sure you're aware of that, because the recall is not happening. And she was kind of surprised, because there had been rumors going around that we had 10,000 signatures, that we were just acting like we didn't have enough so people would keep collecting, and which is a strategy people do sometimes when signature collecting. And but, you know, no, we didn't have enough. And so there was a good bluff going on, but I told her, I said, forget the bluff. You have to act. And she was thankful for the call. I'd also met with Alyssa Silverman the night before and others who I knew were for expulsion. I'd been reaching out to them saying, you got to vote. Like, don't wait any longer. When this thing doesn't qualify for the ballot, Jack's going to say that this just shows there's not enough support to remove him from office. And instead of, like, the real truth is it's the most signatures ever collected in Ward 2 for anything. And, you know, it was, like, by a large number, too. And it's the most signatures ever collected for a recall in the history of the city. So, yeah, you know, we didn't make it, but in a way, like, I didn't want it anyway. I didn't want it that bad. What I really wanted him to do was resign or even agree just not to run for office again. You know, and that was something that we had, as a community, had been, you know, behind this recall. We set our parameters out at the very beginning back in February, like, what's it going to take for us to quit? And it's like, he promises not to run for office again. That's enough. So we don't want to waste taxpayers' money and piss off the voters and drag people out to the polls when there's no, you know, good reason to. And but there was here. And so ultimately that vote that took place to expel him, which was a real surprise for everybody, because I thought it was going to be censure. But nobody would advocate for censure. And they just went straight to expulsion, and they started with the people who were against him. And as they went down the line, the D.C. Council, it got to, you know, it got to the moderates, and the moderates weren't willing to go out on a limb for him. And then finally, someone like, you know, Phil Mendelson, who was really an ally of Jack Evans, the chairman of the D.C. Council, Phil Mendelson, you know, in the end said some bullshit like, I'm not ready to vote. Right. And they've been talking about this for months. You know, and finally he did agree to expulsion because he saw where the sense of the rest of the council was, and he didn't want to be the only one standing up for Jack and just tie him to the corruption. And also, lastly, Vincent Gray, you know, he had been defending Jack a little bit as well in the media, saying, like, it's not fair how he's being treated. He hasn't been convicted of anything. He should be able to keep his job. This happened to me. And I personally lobbied him and said, hey, you know, Vincent Gray, you really are not, what happened to you and what Jack did are not at all comparable. And you really are doing yourself a disservice by comparing the two. And I reminded him of that. And I think he, when he voted, I was just so shocked when he voted for expulsion, because he was practically defending him a week or two earlier in the media. So they all sort of jumped ship from the Jack ship when I think they thought the recall might happen. And they didn't want to be the people sticking their neck out supporting him. So, I was really pleased with the outcome of that vote. And then later, of course, Jack decided he would resign. They had to have two more votes. They did have one more vote, and then the final vote didn't have to happen. And it was about, it would have happened around the 20th. So, or 21st. Well,
they said his last day was Friday.
Yeah.
The 17th.
Can he run again, Adam? Can he run in the special election? Can he run for his seat again now that he's resigned?
The only way he can't run is if he's sitting behind bars.
Well, that's right. If he's sitting behind bars, he can't.
And I don't know if he'll be behind bars, but, I do think there are crimes here. And I think just having to be forced out of office isn't really justice here.
I agree. I
think the taxpayers got taken on these deals that he was behind over the years. But let's talk about, if you don't mind, I'd love to talk about what's happening now in the Ward 2 race. Because it's really, just for the record, I'm not running for the seat. I did lead the recall, and I feel like I educated a lot of people, my project, if you will. I mean, we had about 80 volunteer signature collectors in the community over 6 months. And that really does, over time, change a community's attitudes. We knocked on thousands of doors. We stood in front of all the supermarkets in the ward. We learned a lot. We have a lot of data now about who really lives here and who doesn't, that kind of thing. But when we were campaigning on the recall, I asked these would-be council members who wanted to are challenging Jack, at least. No, maybe not challenging him now, but they thought they were challenging Jack. There was very quickly six candidates. And I was like, this is too many candidates. Like, he can get 25% and win this race. And I actually think he has at least 25% support still. Just from knocking on doors, I can tell you that's probably the case. Well, I asked these campaigns to help and help me make the recall happen. Let's get him out of office. It'll help you get elected. And the only campaigns that even remotely tried to help were Kishan Putta, the ANC commissioner who has been on both ends of the ward. He's had two different ANC positions. And then Yalin, her last name is escaping me, but her first name is Yalin. I had just met her recently. She helped for one night, I guess. And Kishan helped a little bit more. But they actually collected signatures. And I thought that it went a long way with me, that they were... This was smart. They were with us. They were supporting this community effort. Other candidates were sort of like on the fence about helping Daniel Hernandez. But people like Jordan Grossman or Patrick Kennedy, who used to be a co-chair of Jack Evans's campaign for council in the previous election, I mean, those guys didn't help at all. I'm not sure why they didn't. I just felt kind of dissed, by them not helping. So I've decided to, now that we're into the race, I've decided to endorse Kishan Putta. I want diversity in the council. I want someone who's already been responsive in the community for 10 years as an AEC commissioner in both the eastern half and western half of the communities where he's been elected a representative. He's the only person who's been elected to two different AECs. I think it says a lot about somebody who's really committed to the community. And last thing I'll say about Kishon is, like, you know, there are a lot of transportation problems, especially around 16th Street in D.C. with buses and them being too crowded by the time they get to 16th Street to take people downtown, and because people from, you know, further out are filling the bus before it gets downtown. And Kishon fought really hard to get, like, added transportation in the neighborhood, and he succeeded. It was like a 6-year effort, but he actually got it done. And, you know, I just want someone who's been a proven, effective leader in the community, who's not motivated by greed, but is really motivated by making a better community and a more livable community for our families. I mean, I have a daughter who goes to Duke Ellington in Ward 2. You know, it's the arts high school in D.C., if people didn't know that, and it's really a great institution. But Jack Evans was on the side of a group of private schoolers who had access to a field nearby, and for years made a sweetheart deal with a private school that his son went to that would have exclusive use of a field, while 8 other schools have no field in the area. 8 schools. And only now we're getting that field back for the community use, because it's public land. It was just another kind of thing Jack did. You know, it was like, if you were rich and you liked private schools, well, Jack was your guy.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you, in addition of who you're for, let me ask you about a guy that you're not for, and that's Andy Harris. Are you going to... You were down in Ocean City last year. In fact, we sent some of our staff down to help you, because this guy, if our listeners don't know, Andy Harris is a congressman from Maryland who constantly interferes with the District of Columbia. So people
his,
in the
his
District
His budget rider is still in effect, but it's really, I want to call it Mitch McConnell's rider, because it was put back in the Senate. I'm not going to throw Nancy Pelosi under the bus, and I feel like she's in a tough position. But she could have thrown the rider out. She could have said, "This is a dirty bill. I'm not going along with the continuing resolution." But apparently, there is an agreement between Mitch McConnell and Nancy Pelosi that there'll be no poison pills in the continuing resolutions that keep our government open. And in the budget. And so anything that removes a rider or adds a rider that's not there is considered a poison pill. So if the rider was there in 2015, it's still there. And even though we took back the House and the Democrats took the rider out in committee, it got put back in conference. And we were warned from Norton's office that that would likely happen, and that it's because of this wider... the reason we need the no poison pill thing is that there are a lot of good things still in the budget that we don't want to see get defunded, all kinds of programs and such. And if the Dems are able to actually change the budget, then the Republicans want to change the budget too. And so with these two divided government, I guess this is how we keep the government funded, is that nothing changes. And that's really frustrating, and it's another reason why we need to elect Democrats in the next election cycle, so we can actually get this rider removed. But Andy Harris, oh, geez, he's one of Trump's biggest defenders, and yes, he's on the Eastern Shore, and he's disliked in his district, even though it's a Republican, 63% majority Republican district. His last election, I think he got 56%. So He's slipping in popularity, even among Republicans. We shut down the house that I've been renting there last year, actually in 2018, in December of 2018. So I haven't really been out there very much. I mean, we made a lot of good friends for D.C. statehood and for fighting for home rule in D.C. and marijuana reform. But, I I'm kind of ready to move on. The state that I'm most interested in right now in the region is Virginia, because there's a lot happening in Virginia. I think Virginia might legalize cannabis in the next year.
So where do we stand?
That's really good, really smart. What now?
So where do we stand on that? You know, you've got you've got 33 states where there's medical marijuana and 12 jurisdictions, including the District of Columbia, where there's recreational marijuana. So there's still, what's that? There's still 20 states or so that are holdouts. Where do we stand on all this?
Well, it's a civil rights disaster in those states that still haven't reformed. I mean, even now, Virginia is just a terrible place to get caught with marijuana, unless you're in Fairfax or Alexandria counties where the district attorneys have announced that they're making it a low priority for prosecution. Rest of the state, I mean, they're still prosecuting people and putting you in jail for a year for a small amount of marijuana is not uncommon, or a small amount of any drug. You know, I'm personally for ending the drug war. I don't know if you've heard, but there is a new ballot initiative that's being introduced by a proposer named Melissa Lavassani. I'm the treasurer for the campaign, and it's called Decriminalize Nature. And the ballot initiative would make it the lowest law enforcement priority for mushrooms, ayahuasca, ibogaine, and mescaline, which are cactus plants that have mescaline in them, which there are many. So these are substances that people use often to treat depression and PTSD, and a lot of chronic mental illness has been treated with mushrooms successfully for years, and there's hundreds of studies. Johns Hopkins has a whole institute researching it. So this is something that will be on the ballot in D.C. Hopefully soon. And I'm very, very supportive of it, but I'm generally not supposed to talk about it in the media. And this call I thought was me more about Jack Evans, but I figure I'd just take it since we're going to be on here so long that I would just mention that. And people can look it up at decrimnaturedc.org is the website. And there's going to be a community-wide election happening on February 8th for a steering committee member who's from the community. It currently is a small steering committee of just three people, but we want to expand it and have more community input. But while we don't know if there's a large number of people going to jail currently in D.C. or the region for psychedelics, the people do. We don't have the data. You know, no one has actually gotten data out of the police yet about really how many people were being arrested, but it is a number that is unacceptable regardless. And, you know, I think when you hear the story of our proposer, she's a mother who works for D.C. government in the budget office. Her and her husband, they both work in the D.C. government, and they had their second child. She became very suicidal and depressed and just, you know, getting professional help for this, seeing a psychiatrist, seeing a psychologist, taking lots of medications. And, you know, this isn't the knock pharmaceuticals, but they just weren't working for her. And she was just nothing was working. She was not getting out of the state of depression she was in. And her husband, you know, and her, like, figured out that they could just grow their own mushrooms and try that. But that was actually something people did for depression. And she did, and immediately saw relief, and then later went up to New York and had an ayahuasca ceremony, and that ceremony this is a plant from the Amazon that she was ingesting, and that ceremony, she said, it really changed her life and brought her back to the person that she had been missing for so long because of the depression, and she was able to go back to work and raise her kids, and marriage got on better ground because, you know, nobody's happy when someone's like can't get out of bed every day.
What about marijuana, though? What about marijuana in the district?
I mean, the mayor's proposal is awful. I'm not supportive of the mayor's. For me, I'd rather have no bill passed than what the mayor is proposing right now. And I've already made it clear to the mayor in meetings with her staff that, you know, you're getting it all wrong. You're limiting the number of points of sale. You need to have a very easy access to being a seller of cannabis. You need to make it super, super easy to sell cannabis. You want to limit the number of producers. I mean, you want to limit the number of sellers. You're going to have a giant underground economy just like we have now.
Where do we stand with Congress, though? Adam, where are we? Oh, we're still not allowed to make our own laws on this. Is
well, that's,
that right?
That's what I'm trying to say. That's why I'm moving on to other problems with the drug war. You know, that's why I'm focusing on plant-based medicines, because it's true. There's nothing we can do as long as the Senate is in control of the Republicans. And when the Republicans lose the Senate and the Democrats have both branches of the House, Senate, and the White House, then, only then, do we have a chance to remove the rider, which we will. But I guarantee you the mayor's bill that she's going to put forward will be so unacceptable to the marijuana activists in the city that we won't support it. And it will only benefit a small number of well-capitalized business people, people not even from this area. And it's just, they're getting it all wrong. They're trying to keep the price of marijuana high when the real benefit is making marijuana cheap and having all kinds of added value businesses where people go and, like, for instance, like, we have no social use of cannabis happening in the District of Columbia right now. If you go to San Francisco now, there are lounges. They are popping off. People are going out. They're having a good time. There's music, culture. It's beautiful. And you can smoke cannabis. It's not a big deal, but people are drinking a lot less. And it's a healthier lifestyle to be smoking cannabis than it is to be drinking hard liquor all the time. And this is a big drinking town. We have a ton of bars and nightclubs. They need to transition over to cannabis clubs. But that's not going to happen under the mayor's vision. And also part of the problem is we need to not ghettoize the sale of cannabis. It shouldn't be in just one location or you know, just one type of business. You should be able to buy cannabis at Whole Foods. You should be able to buy cannabis at your natural supermarket. You should be able to buy cannabis at the farmer's market from a local D.C. grower. But you're not going to get that with the mayor's bill, and that's what we told her. It's like you need to have licenses for regular people, for people who grow at home. There's nothing wrong with home grow. Home grow has less pesticides and chemicals than the big factory farm grows, which are supplying all these dispensaries. And if they think that people aren't spraying chemicals on these indoor grows, they totally are. So people under the medical marijuana program are smoking chemicals that are sprayed on the plants so they don't lose their crop to bugs and other kinds of pests that get into your crop. Growing indoors is really hard. You know, growing indoors requires a ton of light generated from electricity. You know, and all this light that's being used indoors is so wasteful, and it makes our power grid, it taxes our power grid, and it makes our electric bill higher. It makes everyone's electric bill higher when we could just be growing under the sun. I don't want to grow cannabis in D.C. in warehouses. It's a poor use of warehouse space. Cannabis should be grown on farms in farm states and shipped to Washington, D.C., just like any other crop, just like wine, just like, you know, we don't grow wine here. Nobody grows their grapes here, and we drink so much wine in this town. And we get the best wine from all over the world. Why you think we're going to get the best cannabis grown in a dingy warehouse in Southeast? No way. No way. Wow. And so the best cannabis is grown under the sun in Northern California. And that's where the best wine is. So this legalization proposal that the Democrats nationally and Democrats locally are putting forward is dead on arrival with activists. We want interstate commerce. So I'm pulling this out because, like, I you know, the mayor has positioned herself as a pro-marijuana mayor, but she's not, okay? To people who actually think about the policy, she's terrible. She's going to put in place a policy that enriches just a few of her friends.
Well, that's...
Right, I'm getting upset about this because the voters are waiting. They want this legal. We don't want mini monopolies. We don't want, you know, and what about the racial justice issue of this? There'll be no racial justice if only well-capitalized millionaires are the ones who own the businesses. You know, you need to make it so if you want to have a home-based business, and you want to, then it's a $125 license, and then you pay taxes just like everybody else. You know, and we do that with so many different types of businesses. Oh, but with cannabis, we can't do that. That's just BS.
Well, go ahead, Maria. Ask your question.
I just wanted to ask Adam. I know you had Capital Hemp, and it had to close, but then I read that it reopened. Is it still open?
Yes. Capital Hemp is, I don't own it anymore, though. I sold to my business partner, Alan Amsterdam, and another gentleman. The store is still located in Adams Morgan, just a block from the old location. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a lot of competition now, so, you know, we kind of, like, hurt ourselves. We were, like, the only proper head shop, smoke shop in town for a good 5 years. And then we got raided, and that kind of led to the legalization initiative for me, because it was sort of like, well, I'm tired of playing games. Let's just change the law. And we had, you know, took advantage of the ballot initiative process. But, you know, the store is true. It still has hemp products. It still has locally blown glass. The store actually sells cannabis now, but it's not THC cannabis. So, but there's CBD.
CBD, okay.
And, you know, you can buy CBD all over the place. I've been using more CBD products more and more. Like, I actually find them, for me, the reason I use cannabis generally is wellness and, you know, stress and my arthritis. So, but
well,
I,
my 87-year-old mother.
I have had mild depression probably my whole life at times, and sometimes it's worse. And I've been using mushrooms almost since I was 18 years old. And that is something that I've kept in the closet until very, very recently. And lots of people, I think, are tired of keeping it in the closet now. So there is another wave of reform coming in the 2020s, and I think it's going to be psychedelics.
Well, we're running out of time here, Adam. Is there anything you want to talk about that we haven't talked about?
Yes, going back to the Jack Evans election, a special election. So something would happen on January 8th. The Board of Elections announced the special election would be 2 weeks after Democratic primary, which is June 3rd. So Ward 2 is not going to have a council member between now and, I think it's the 16th, is that right?
Of June,
special
yeah.
Special election. So that seems like a really long time. Or 17th, I guess, June 17th. So
yeah, it's 5 months.
That's just not right. Especially, why are we electing people for a 2021 position before we fill the 2020 position seat that's still open? It just seems like the order should be the other way, you know, like we should be having the special election like in the spring. Having it on the same day as the primary and just give people from Ward 2 would have two, they'd be voting twice in the council slot. But, and that way you could vote for the same person and just put them there at the exact same time and the same voters. It's also going to cost $200,000 to have a special election after the primary. Mm-hmm. So I'm calling on the D.C. Council to enact special legislation, emergency legislation, to move the primary to the, at the very least, to move the special election to the primary.
Well, you know, I would think that if you're in the primary, you'd also want to be in the special election the way it's laid out. Is that not true? I mean, I guess, you know,
they're going to have a special election to fill his seat 2 weeks after the primary.
Right.
The people will have to go back to the polls.
Yeah,
we can do all this in one election
voter turnout.
And give people two ballots.
Right.
You know, we could say here's the special election ballot and here's the primary ballot.
Well, that seems to make sense. And I would think that,
you know, everybody gets to vote in the special election, independents, Democrats, Republicans, Greens, statehood Greens. But, not everybody gets to vote in the primary, right? Because independents are not in a party, they don't get to vote. So I guess the logic was, well, you know, independents don't know to come on the primary day. But they could be educated to that is the special election, so independents can vote that day. Anyway, I'm kind of disturbed by this whole thing. And the mayor just appointed a new person to the Board of Elections. This entire Board of Elections is only three people. They have been all appointed by the current mayor. And so basically I think she's deciding how this election's going down. And they're providing Jack Evans a way to get back into good graces. You know, he resigns and then he works on his reputation for a few months and then he runs, you know, and he's running he'll be the seventh candidate, you know, seven-way race. He might win in the primary.
Yeah.
It's just really sketchy.
That's strange.
So I've been really upset about this the last couple of days, that after all this community work has been done to get him out of office, that he has the gall to be calling up people for the last couple of days. Apparently he's been calling his longtime friends in the ward and saying that he's going to wait until, early end of the month, but he's going to announce that he's running again after he just resigned.
I know. That's amazing. Well, Adam Eidinger, we're out of time. Thank you so much for being on the show. We hope to have you again someday soon. Good luck with everything you're working on.
It's been too long.
So thanks for coming on again. We'll see you soon. Everybody, tomorrow's Martin Luther King's Day, of course, in America. So we're going to leave you with a psalm by James Taylor, which is very inspiring, dedicated to Dr. King. And Maria, since you didn't get to say much, what would you like to say?
Just want to always thank our listeners who make the time out of their weeks to make Shadow Politics a part of your listening. We're very grateful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, let us turn our thoughts today to Martin Luther King and recognize that there are ties between us.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.